Here, FDR shows his lighter side at the annual Teamsters Union Banquet, September 23, 1944, at the Hotel Statler in Washington, D.C.
These Republican leaders have not been content with attacks on me, or on my wife, or on my sons. No, not content with that. They now include my little dog, Fallon. You know, Fallon's Scotch. And being a Scotty, as soon as he learned that the Republican fiction writers in Congress and out had concocted a story that I'd left him behind on an Aleutian island and had sent a destroyer back to find him at a cost to the taxpayers of $2 or $3 or $8 or $20 million, his Scotch soul was furious. He has not been the same dog since. I am accustomed to hearing malicious falsehoods about myself, such as that old worm-eaten chestnut, that I have represented myself as indispensable. But I think I have a right to resent, to object to libelous statements about my dog.
Welcome and thanks for listening to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just joining us, we're listening to Chris Hedges talk about his book, The Empire of Illusion, in the style of an Old Testament prophet. Chris Hedges decries the coming capitalist totalitarianism and urges activists to promote democratic socialism. Journalist Chris Hedges discusses the dramatic rise of a post-literate society that craves fantasy, ecstasy, and illusion. And now here is Chris Hedges.
Brand Obama has refused to ease restrictions so workers can organize. And because of pressure from the for-profit healthcare industry, will not consider single-payer, not-for-profit healthcare for all Americans. And Brand Obama will not prosecute the Bush administration for war crimes, including the use of torture, and has refused to dismantle Bush's secrecy laws or restore habeas corpus. Corporations which control our politics no longer produce products that are different, but brands that are different. And Brand Obama does not threaten the core of the corporate state any more than did Brand George W. Bush. The Bush brand collapsed. We became immune to its studied folksiness. We saw through its artifice, and this is a common deflation in the world of advertising. So we have been given a new Obama brand with an exciting and faintly erotic appeal. Benetton and Calvin Klein were the precursors to the Obama brand. Using ads to associate themselves with risque style and progressive politics, it gave their products an edge. But the goal, as with all brands, was to fool passive consumers that a brand is an experience. The decline of American empire began long before the current economic meltdown or the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. It began before the first Gulf War or Ronald Reagan. It began when we shifted, in the words of the Harvard historian Charles Mayer, from an empire of production to an empire of consumption. By the end of the Vietnam War, when the costs of the war ate away at Lyndon Johnson's great society, and domestic oil production began its steady, inexorable decline, we saw our country transformed from one that primarily produced to one that primarily consumed. We started borrowing to maintain a lifestyle as well as an empire we could no longer afford. We began to use force, especially in the Middle East, to feed our insatiable thirst for cheap oil. And the bill is now due. America's most dangerous enemies are not Islamic radicals, but those who sold us the perverted ideology of free market capitalism and globalization. They have dynamited the foundations of our society. In the 17th century, these speculators would have been hung. Today, they run the government and consume billions in taxpayer subsidies. These corporate forces will never permit real reform. It would mean their extinction. The oil and gas industry will never allow us to achieve energy independence. That would devastate their profits. Real reform would wipe out tens of billions of dollars in weapons contracts. It would cripple the financial health of a host of private contractors, from Lockheed Martin to Boeing to Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, Halliburton, Blackwater, now renamed Z. And it would render obsolete the existence of the U.S. Central Command. It was Bill Clinton who led the Democratic Party to the corporate watering trough. Clinton argued that the party could ditch labor unions, no longer a source of votes or power, as a political ally. Workers, he insisted, would vote Democratic anyway. They had no choice. It was better, he argued, to take corporate money and do corporate bidding. By the 1990s, the Democratic Party, under Clinton's leadership, had virtual fundraising parity with the Republicans. Today, the Democrats get more. The legislation demanded by corporations, including the North American Free Trade Agreement, thrust a knife into the back of the American working class. NAFTA was peddled by the Clinton White House as an opportunity to raise incomes and prosperity of the citizens of the United States, Canada, and Mexico. NAFTA would also, we were told, staunch Mexican immigration into the United States. But NAFTA, which took effect in 1994, reversed every one of Clinton's rosy predictions. Once the Mexican government lifted price supports on corn and beans grown by Mexican farmers, those farmers had to compete against the huge agribusinesses in the United States. Many Mexican farmers were swiftly bankrupt. At least 2 million Mexican farmers have been driven off their land since 1994. And guess where many of them went? This desperate flight of poor Mexicans into the United States is now being exacerbated by large-scale factory closures along the border as manufacturers pack up and leave Mexico for China. But we were assured that goods would be cheaper, workers would be wealthier, everyone would be happier. I'm not sure how these contradictory things were supposed to happen, but in a soundbite society, reality no longer matters. NAFTA was great if you were a corporation. It was a disaster if you were a worker. And we are now getting a taste of Clinton's draconian welfare reform bill, signed in 1996, as tens of millions of people face the prospect of losing their unemployment benefits and attempting to survive on $143 a month from welfare. It was the Clinton administration, led by Summers, which signed into law the Financial Services Modernization Act of 1999. The act ripped down the firewalls that had been established by the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act, designed to prevent the kind of meltdown we are now experiencing. Glass-Steagall established the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It set in place banking reforms to stop speculators from hijacking the financial system. With Glass-Steagall demolished and the passage of NAFTA, the Democrats, led by Clinton, tumbled gleefully into bed with corporations and Wall Street speculators. And many of the architects of this deregulation, economists such as Summers, have come back again to service these corporations in the Obama White House. The cost of our empire of illusion is not being paid for by corporate titans. It is being paid for on the streets of our inner cities, in former manufacturing towns, and in depressed rural enclaves. Human beings are not commodities. They are not goods. Their misery is not the regrettable price of globalization and the free market. They grieve and suffer and feel despair. They raise children and struggle to maintain communities. And the growing class divide is not grasped, despite the glibness of many in the media, by complicated sets of statistics, lines on a graph that charts stocks, or the absurd utopian faith in unregulated globalization and complicated trade deals. It is understood in the eyes of a man or woman who is no longer making enough money to live with dignity and hope. The growing desperation across the United States is unleashing not simply a recession. We have been in a recession for some time now, but a depression unlike anything we have seen since the 1930s. It has provided a pool of broken people willing to work for low wages and to do without unions or benefits. For the bottom 90% of Americans, annual income has been on a slow, steady decline for three decades. There are 50 million Americans in real poverty and tens of millions of Americans in a category called near poverty. And our elites, meanwhile, manipulate statistics and data to foster illusions of growth and prosperity to mask the damage. They refuse to admit, at least to us, that they have lost control, since to lose control is to concede failure. They contribute instead to the collective denial of reality by insisting that another multi-billion dollar bailout or government loan will prop up the shattered edifice. The well-paid television pundits and news celebrities, the economists and the banking and financial sector leaders see the world from inside the comfort of the corporate box, and they are loyal to the corporate state. The assault on the American working class, an assault that has devastated members of my own family in the former mill towns in the state of Maine, shows no sign of abatement. In the past 3 years, nearly one in five U.S. workers was laid off. Among workers laid off from full-time work, roughly one-fourth were earning less than $40,000 a year. And there are whole sections of the United States that now resemble the developing world. There's been a Weimarization of the American working class, and the assault on the middle class is underway. Anything that can be put on software, from finance to architecture to engineering, can and is being outsourced to workers in countries such as India or China, who accept pay a fraction of that of their Western counterparts and work without benefits. And both the Republican and Democratic parties, beholden to corporations for money and power, are responsible. Washington has become our Versailles. The media has evolved into a class of courtiers. The Democrats, like the Republicans, are mostly courtiers. Our pundits, academics, economists, and experts, at least those with prominent public platforms, are courtiers. We are captivated by the hollow stagecraft of political theater as we are ruthlessly stripped of power. The role of courtiers is to parrot official propaganda. Courtiers do not defy the elite or question the structure of the corporate state. The corporations, in return, employ them and promote them as celebrities or elected officials. Courtiers in face powder deceive us in the name of journalism. Courtiers in our political parties promise to look out for our interests and then pass bill after bill to further corporate fraud and abuse. No class of courtiers, from the eunuchs behind the Manchus in the 19th century to the Baghdad caliphs in the Abbasid caliphate, has ever transformed itself into a responsible and socially productive class. Being a courtier requires agility and eloquence, and the most talented of them should be credited as persuasive actors. They entertain us, they make us feel good, they persuade us, they are our friends. They are the smiley faces of a corporate state that has hijacked the government. And when these corporations make their iron demands, these courtiers drop to their knees. They placate the telecommunications companies that want to be protected from lawsuits. They permit oil and gas companies to rake in obscene profits and keep in place the vast subsidies of corporate welfare doled out by the state. They allow our profit-driven healthcare system to leave the uninsured and underinsured to suffer and die. And over 20,000 Americans died last year because they could not get proper medical care. A healthcare industry, like the defense industry, profits from death. It is legally permitted to hold sick children hostage while their families frantically bankrupt themselves to save their son or daughter. Any discussion of healthcare should acknowledge the fact that our for-profit healthcare system is the problem and must be destroyed. Only then can we have an honest debate about what comes next. But this will never happen. It will never happen because the industry's money and lobbyists drive the discussion, and the courtiers in Washington and on the television screens dance to the tune they play. America is devolving into a third world nation, and if we do not immediately halt our elite's rapacious looting of the public treasury and our bizarre state socialism for corporations, we will be left with trillions in debts which can never be repaid, and widespread human misery which we will be helpless to ameliorate. Our anemic democracy will be replaced with a robust national police state. The elite will withdraw into heavily guarded, gated communities where they will have access to security, goods, and services that cannot be afforded by the rest of us. And tens of millions of people, brutally controlled, will live in perpetual poverty, a state of neo-feudalism. This is the inevitable result of unchecked corporate capitalism. The stimulus and bailout plans are not about saving us. They are about saving them. As the economist Paul Krugman has noted, anyone who has seen how economic statistics are constructed knows that they are a subgenre of science fiction. This science fiction has been steadily employed to camouflage our economic decline. President Ronald Reagan included 1.5 million U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine service personnel with the civilian workforce to magically reduce the nation's unemployment rate by 2%. President Clinton decided that those who had given up looking for work, or those who wanted full-time jobs but could only find part-time employment, were no longer to be counted as unemployed. His trick disappeared some 5 million unemployed from the official unemployment rolls. If you work more than 21 hours a week, and most low-wage workers at places like Walmart average about 28 hours a week, you are counted as employed, although your real wages put you below the poverty line. Our actual unemployment rate, as the Los Angeles Times has pointed out, when you include those who have stopped looking for work and those who can only find poorly paid part-time jobs, is not 10%, but somewhere between 17 and 20%. A sixth of the country is now effectively unemployed, and we are shedding jobs at a faster rate than in the months after the 1929 crash. Franklin Delano Roosevelt recognized the danger of unregulated capitalism. He sent a message to Congress on April 29, 1938, titled "Recommendations to the Congress to Curb Monopolies and the Concentration of Economic Power." In it, he wrote this: "The first truth is that the liberty of democracy is not safe. If the people tolerate the growth of power to a point where it becomes stronger than the democratic state itself, that, in its essence, is fascism. Ownership of government by an individual, by a group, or by any other controlling private power. The second truth is that the liberty of a democracy is not safe. If its business system does not provide employment and produce and distribute goods in such a way to sustain an acceptable standard of living. The rise of the corporate state has grave political consequences, as we saw in Italy and Germany in the early part of the 20th century. Antitrust laws not only regulate and control the marketplace, they serve as bulwarks to protect democracy. And now that they are gone, now that we have a state run by and on behalf of corporations, we must expect inevitable and, I fear, terrifying consequences. As the pressure mounts, as this despair and desperation reaches into larger and larger segments of the populace, the mechanisms of corporate and government control are being bolstered to prevent civil unrest and instability. The emergence of the corporate state always means the emergence of the security state. And this is why the Bush White House pushed through the Patriot Act and its renewal, the suspension of habeas corpus, the practice of extraordinary rendition, warrantless wiretapping of American citizens, and the refusal to ensure free and fair elections with verifiable ballot counting. The motive behind these measures is not to fight terrorism or to bolster national security. It is to seize and maintain internal control, and it is about control of us. Senator Frank Church, as chairman of the Select Committee on Intelligence in 1975, investigated the government's massive and highly secretive National Security Agency. He was alarmed at the ability of the state to intrude into private lives. He wrote, when he finished his investigation, "That capacity at any time could be turned around on the American people, and no American would have any privacy left. Such phone conversations, telegrams, it doesn't matter. There would be no place to hide. If this government ever became a tyranny, if a dictator ever took charge in this country, the technological capacity that the intelligence community has given the government could enable it to impose total tyranny, and there would be no way to fight back, because the most careful effort to combine together in resistance to the government, no matter how privately it was done, is within the reach of the government to know." When Senator Church made this statement, the NSA was not authorized to spy on American citizens. Today it is. In his book, The Great Transformation, written in 1944, Carl Polanyi laid out the devastating consequences, the depressions, wars, and totalitarianism that grow out of a so-called self-regulated free market. He grasped that fascism, like socialism, was rooted in a market society that refused to function. He warned that a financial system always devolved without heavy government control into a mafia capitalism and a mafia political system. All traditional standards and beliefs are shattered in a severe economic crisis. The moral order is turned upside down. The honest and industrious are wiped out, while the gangsters, profiteers, and speculators walk away with millions. A self-regulating market inevitably turns human beings and the natural environment into commodities, a situation that ensures the destruction of both society and the natural world. The free market's assumption that nature and human beings are objects whose worth is determined by the market allows each to be exploited for profit until exhaustion or collapse. A society that no longer recognizes that nature and human life have a sacred dimension, an intrinsic value beyond monetary value, commits collective suicide. Such societies cannibalize themselves until they die. We face an environmental meltdown that is linked to our economic meltdown. Polar ice caps are melting. Sea levels are rising. The planet is warming at an alarming rate. Droughts are destroying croplands. Russia's northern coastline has begun producing huge quantities of toxic methane gas. Scientists with the International Siberian Shelf Study described what they saw along the coastline recently as methane chimneys reaching from the sea floor to the ocean surface. Methane, locked in the permafrost of the Arctic landmasses, is being released at an alarming rate as average Arctic temperatures rise. Methane is a greenhouse gas 25 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. The release of millions of tons of it will significantly accelerate the rate of global warming.
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men a-lying, I saw many more a-dying, but I ain't a marching. talking anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plant, United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore. No, I ain't marching anymore.
More from great speeches and interviews after these messages.